Hear that? Yeah, that's the sound of you relaxing, because now you're managing diabetes with the Freestyle Libre 3 system. You get to know your glucose levels and where it's headed. Manage your diabetes with more confidence with the Freestyle Libre 3 system. Ready to learn more about the number one prescribed CGM in the U.S.? Visit freestylelibre.us to learn more. Based on retail sales data for patients last filled prescription by manufacturer, refer to the FLAIR NL4 study published in BMJ Open Diabetes Research and Care 2019. Safety info found at freestylelibre.us.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. This is your host, Dan Zupansky, for the program True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. To ensure that the villainous captives were fit for trial at Nuremberg, the U.S. Army sent an ambitious Army psychiatrist, Captain Douglas M. Kelly, to supervise their mental well-being during their detention. Kelly realized he was being offered the professional opportunity of a lifetime to discover a distinguishing trait among these arch criminals that would mark them as psychologically different from the rest of humanity. So began a remarkable relationship between Kelly and his captors, told here for the first time with unique access to Kelly's long-hidden papers and medical records. Kelly's was a hazardous quest, dangerous because, against all his expectations, he began to appreciate and understand some of the Nazi captives, none more so than the former Reich Marshal Hermann Göring. Evil had its charms. The book that we're discussing this evening is The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, with my special guest, journalist and author, Jack L. High. Welcome to the program, and thank you for agreeing to this interview, Jack L. High.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me here.
And I did have an opportunity to ask you if that's the way you pronounce your name. Is that the way properly to pronounce your name, Jack?
Absolutely. You got it right.
Okay, great. I want to say congratulations and thank you very much for this book. An amazing, incredible read. And so I know our audience is going to sit back here and really enjoy this interview. So congratulations on a fantastic and very, very compelling book.
Thank you. I think it may have been the project of a lifetime.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, first off, before we get into setting the stage where this incredible story began, and how did you come to be involved with this story, to write this book, and why?
It happened in a quite unusual way. I had previously written another book called The Lobotomist, which came out several years ago. That book is about the psychiatrist who is the main advocate and developer of the treatment called lobotomy to treat psychiatric illness. And as it turned out, that psychiatrist who I wrote about at that time had a side interest in studying his fellow psychiatrists who had taken their own lives. And so he had written a little bit about Douglas M. Kelly, and it was very tantalizing what he had written. And so that stayed in my mind, this Dr. Kelly's story, and I decided to see if I can find out some more about it. I learned pretty quickly that there were not many of Dr. Kelly's papers or records that were in publicly accessible archives, And so I decided to try and seek out his surviving family members. And after a great deal of trouble, I did find Dr. Kelly's oldest son, Doug, who was at that time living in Northern California, not very far, as it turned out, from where my mother was living at that time. And I wrote to Doug and asked him if he had, told him about my interest in his father's career, and asked him if he had any of his father's papers or records. He answered that he did, and he invited me to come and come sometime and take a look. And I did come by and visit Doug in his home. It was one of the most remarkable days of my writing life, I think. The day that I walked into Doug's house and he pointed to the stack of boxes that he had brought up and set in his living room and said, "Here it is. Have your way with it." And I had been expecting that maybe Doug had some file folders, but I did not expect to see a mountain of boxes. And then Doug left the room and left me alone with these boxes of documents. And I opened up the first, removed the first lid, and saw that it was a remarkable collection of things that should be in museums and archives, because Dr. Kelly had brought home from Nuremberg psychiatric records of the top 22 Nazis who faced trial in the first Nuremberg trial, the International Military Tribunal, other medical records, other artifacts that he brought back from Nuremberg, his notebooks and memos, and all kinds of papers. It was an incredible mother load of fantastic information, and that is what I based the book on.
Now, just curious, this is not really part of the book, but did you know beforehand, were you aware of the existence of Kelly's book, 22 Cells?
I quickly became aware of it. Dr. Kelly had written a book during the late 1940s after he returned to the States from Nuremberg called 22 Cells in Nuremberg. And it's consists of his psychological profiles of each of those 22 defendants. It's really not an account of the Nuremberg trial or any of the judicial proceedings that happened there. And so I was quickly aware of that book once I started looking into Dr. Kelly's life.
Right. Now, you can maybe list, maybe set the stage basically for, we obviously are talking about something that everyone should know and probably does know to a great degree, but of course we're talking about some information that people are just not aware of or not fully aware of, let's put it this way. So this is 1945 after the capture. At the end of the Second World War, and focus of this book is Douglas M. Kelly, but also Hermann Göring. And so tell us, set the stage in 1945 for the events that are discussed in this book, basically the examination by Kelly of these 22 Nazis. So set the stage how these particular Nazi prisoners, where they were first sent, and set the stage for us.
Sure. As the war ended in Europe in the spring of 1945, the Allies were very intent on capturing the Nazi governmental and military leaders. And the Allies had in mind all along that something would be done with these men. There was a little bit of disagreement at first among the Allies what should be done. The Russians and the English wanted very quick judicial proceedings, if there would be judicial proceedings at all, before executing these men. And the Americans wanted a trial that would present the crimes of the Nazis before an international audience. And so that is what ended up happening. Many of the captured Nazi leaders were assembled first in a improvised prison in a village called Mondorf in Luxembourg, And that's actually where Dr. Kelly first met most of them. He was sent first to Mondorf. That's where he met Hermann Göring and many of the others. And when he met Göring, as you mentioned in the introduction, he had an assignment of establishing the mental fitness of these men to stand trial. For someone like Kelly, that was not a difficult thing to do and could be done with relative ease. And he wanted to make use of this opportunity that he had. He was the only psychiatrist given access to these men who were, at the time and probably still are, considered the arch criminals of the 20th century. And he wanted to understand what made them do what they had done. They had committed war crimes and crimes against humanity on a scale never before seen. So what was responsible for this? How did it happen? And he hoped to use psychiatric testing, psychological assessments, and intense interviewing of these men to see if there was a common thread that ran through them. Maybe it was some kind of psychiatric disorder, maybe a personality disorder, something that would link these men together and explain their behavior. Eventually, the Nazis were all moved to Nuremberg. Once it became established that that was where the trial was going to happen, they were moved into a prison wing of a complex called the Palace of Justice in Nuremberg. Kelly traveled along with them and continued his official work, determining the sanity of the Nazis, and then his unofficial work, which claimed most of his attention and enthusiasm, which was this study that he had set up to find whether there are any common psychiatric elements between the men. And he worked with the Nazis. He spent hundreds of hours interviewing them through the summer of 1945, through the fall of that year. The trial began in November 1945, and Kelly remained with them until January 1946. The trial was still underway and had many months to go, but Kelly left at that time. He had found what he needed, he thought, and then returned to the States, and his tour of duty was over. During those months, in addition to interviewing the Nazis, he gave them all a psychological assessment called that some of your listeners may be familiar with, called the Rorschach inkblot test, and some other psychological assessments, one in particular called the thematic apperception test. He also tested them for IQ, and as I mentioned, intensively interviewed them. So that through all of that work, Dr. Kelly hoped to find something in common, and he failed to. With the exception of one of the defendants, he believed that all of the Nazis were sane, not just in the legal sense, which is not a very high bar, but they were sane in the psychiatric sense, which is a higher bar, and in you could tell right from wrong, cognizant of the implications of their actions. But he found no disorders, and this was terribly upsetting to him. Meanwhile, though, he had drawn close, in a sense, to some of the defendants, not close in a friendly way, but close in an intimate way. He got to know them very well, especially Hermann Göring, and he developed a special relationship with Göring, special in degree of closeness. And these two men were quite alike in personality and in narcissism and in faith and confidence in their ability to manipulate others. These were both very strong-willed men, Kelly and Göring. And one upsetting outcome of his time with Göring for Kelly was to see some of himself reflected in what he saw in Göring. Kelly had absolutely no illusions about Göring's criminal qualities, bad qualities, but he also saw a lot of admirable qualities: enduring charm, intelligence, sense of humor, thoughtfulness. And it was very perplexing to Kelly how such a man with such undeniable gifts could have committed such horrible crimes. And so that's really the setting in which a lot of the book takes place.
Well, now let's go back, because this really does unfold like a mystery in terms of Kelly coming in with obviously some conception, perception of what he may find from studying these, and he was very anxious to, again, what his official role was, but what he had in terms of ambition, what he wanted to learn from this, because he was a very dedicated and driven man. So let's go a little bit back, because his family stays in the U.S. while he goes over to, like you say, Luxembourg and then Nuremberg. So tell us a little bit about Douglas M. Kelly before he went to this historic Nuremberg trials and interviewed these Nazis. So tell us a little bit about his background, his wife, his children, what he was like, and then what transpired so that he became involved with the Nazis at Nuremberg.
Well, Douglas Kelly was a remarkable man by his upbringing and by his personal qualities. He grew up in a family that was well known in Northern California. He spent a lot of time growing up in his childhood years in a town called Truckee in Northern California near Lake Tahoe. And his grandfather was an important man in this town of Truckee. He was a newspaper publisher and a historian. And in fact, Kelly's grandfather, Charles McGlashan, was the first historian to research and gather information and write about the Donner Party tragedy of the 19th century, in which a group of westward bound travelers heading to California got caught in a terrible snowstorm in the Sierras and had to winter in those awful conditions. Many of them died, and those who lived ended up cannibalizing the remains of those who had died. And and Kelly's grandfather's home was a museum of Donner Party memorabilia. So Kelly grew up in that kind of setting, and studied at University of California at Berkeley, attended medical school at the University of California, and did further graduate studies at Columbia University, and then returned to California to head up a hospital called the San Francisco Psychopathic Hospital. But very early into his time there as director of that facility, America entered World War II, and Kelly joined the military, was sent to Europe, and was working in the Army's psychiatric service, psychiatric hospitals in Europe that were primarily helping soldiers who had suffered what was then commonly known as shell shock, but what Dr. Kelly would have called combat exhaustion, trauma, in essence, from being in a combat situation or from the stresses of combat. And he developed some very innovative ways of treating combat exhaustion. So that's why he was in Europe.
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. Powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
Hear that? Yeah, that's the sound of you relaxing, because now you're managing diabetes with the Freestyle Libre 3 system. You get to know your glucose levels and where it's headed. Manage your diabetes with more confidence with the Freestyle Libre 3 system. Ready to learn more about the number one prescribed CGM in the U.S.? Visit FreestyleLibre.us to learn more. Based on retail sales data for patients' last filled prescription by manufacturer, refer to the FLAIR NL4 study published in BMJ Open Diabetes Research and Care 2019. Safety info found at FreestyleLibre.us.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then, learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
Meanwhile, before he went to Europe, to the field of battle, had married a socially upward mobile young woman named Vivian Hill, nicknamed Dookie, and they had not yet had children. But they were separated for many years while Dr. Kelly was in the Army service. And at the time the war ended, when the military authorities were looking for a psychiatrist to examine these captive Nazis, Kelly was among the very highest ranking of the psychiatrists in the Army service at the time. And another notable thing about Dr. Kelly was he had become over the years one of the first and best experts in the United States on the use of the...
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Rorschach inkblot test, and had used it quite a bit. He was considered a very skilled, talented interpreter of Rorschach test results, and he himself put a lot of faith in that test, in ways that it's not used anymore. It is still used at times as a personality assessment, but Kelly and other psychiatrists back then were using it often as a way to diagnose psychiatric disorders as well. So that's why he brought the Rorschach with him to Nuremberg and used it to study the Nazis.
The other thing I wanted to ask you is that in his early work, just previous to going to Luxembourg and Nuremberg with these Nazis, you said he had was involved with the study of psychopathology. Is there any evidence that he thought that that's what he would find with these Nazis, especially most of them, that they were, that's what they were, psychopaths?
Yes, he was a psychiatrist, and at the time he believed that if somebody was exhibiting deviant behavior, then there had to be psychiatric roots to it, and that it was his job to find those roots. when, after all his testing and interviewing of the Nazi prisoners at Nuremberg, he did not find psychiatric roots to their behavior, that really turned his world upside down. And it, one of the reasons why, when Dr. Kelly returned to the States, he abandoned clinical psychiatry and instead took up the study and the teaching of criminology. So if psychiatry couldn't give him the answers that he wanted in figuring out the behavior of people like the Nazis, then he thought maybe criminology could explain their criminal behavior. So it really upset and turned Dr. Kelly inside out, that his field of psychiatry couldn't give him the answers he wanted.
Now, he didn't get the answers that he wanted, but it wasn't from lack of trying. So tell us especially about Hermann Göring in terms of when he was first captured or in Luxembourg. He had a certain attitude about the unfolding events, and he was, you know, was quite wrong about those. But tell us about the meeting of Kelly and Hermann Göring.
Well, it was a notable meeting. Göring came into the hands of the Allies in quite a state. He had been captured by the U.S. Army and flown to Luxembourg, and at the time of his capture, he was addicted to a narcotic called pericodine. He was taking up to 100 pericodine tablets per day. And in addition to that, he was very, very overweight, too. So part of what Dr. Kelly saw is something that he must do with Hermann Göring immediately if Göring was to survive in good health to this future trial that was coming, was to help Göring break his dependence on pericodine and also help him lose a great deal of weight. So a lot of their early relationship, their early interactions, revolved around those tasks. And with Kelly's help, Göring did completely break his addiction to pericodine. You know, just as an aside here, I mentioned earlier the boxes full of documents and artifacts that I looked at Kelly's son Doug's house.
Right.
And among those artifacts was a vial filled with about 30 pericodine tablets that Göring had brought with him.
Wow, incredible.
Capture. So anyway, Kelly was also successful in helping Göring lose a great deal of weight, so much so that none of his clothing fit him anymore. But then once those two medical problems were overcome, then a lot of their interactions had took place in these discussions that Kelly and Göring had, very intense discussions at times in Göring's cell. Göring, like all the other 22 of the defendants, was held in solitary confinement for most of the time. And Göring was eager to have company, to have conversation, and so the two men spoke a lot. And they spoke a lot about the events of the war. Kelly asked Göring, along with the other defendants, Kelly asked Göring to write an autobiography that included details of his past and medical details. And they sized each other up and began to practice their talents of manipulation upon one another. And I think they were both aware of this, but they could do things for each other. They could help each other. Göring, for instance, was quite concerned about his family, his wife, and his very young daughter, who were far away, and Göring had not heard from them for a long time. So Kelly helped Göring by carrying letters that Göring had written to Emmy Göring, the wife, and also to Etta, the daughter. And Kelly also provided Goering with that conversation and intellectual stimulation that he craved, and also a sounding board for Goering's ideas that he would develop during these months and then present in his own defense during the trial that was to come. And then Kelly, on the other hand, was also manipulating and needed Goering as one of the linchpins of his study. Goering was the highest-ranking German official in captivity. He was the best-known, and he was in many ways, in Kelly's estimation, the most interesting because of his very apparent intellectual gifts. So that's how the relationship between the two men formed, and Kelly certainly did form relationships with others in the group. Others among the 22, Rudolf Hess joined the group in October 1945. He had been captured in England several years before, and several others, too. Kelly got to know all of them very well.
And what was Hess's role in Hitler's government, for those who don't know?
At the time Hess was captured, he had the title of Deputy Führer. That sounds like he was in second in command, but that is not the case. Goering, at that time, was Hitler's designated successor, but he was high up in the leadership, and he was often a mouthpiece of the government. Often introduced Hitler and others at Nazi rallies, but in 1941, Hess, who had never been completely mentally stable, got the idea that he could broker a peace of sorts between Germany and Great Britain. And he, on his own initiative, flew a plane across the English Channel and landed in Scotland and he was arrested immediately and asked for an audience with Winston Churchill to discuss a kind of brokered peace. Churchill would have nothing to do with him, and Hess was imprisoned in England for the remainder of the war and began showing some signs of mental disturbance, amnesia, paranoia. There were food items, food that Hess would refuse to eat, and sugar and cookies and things like that because he believed they might be poisoned. And Kelly later gathered these up when Hess appeared in Nuremberg and brought them home, and these two were among the artifacts that I saw in the boxes.
Oh, wow. Now, Goering, being the right-hand man to Hitler, also made contact with the Allies. When did this happen, and what was said to the Allies? What did he believe he could do?
Goering had talked with various British officials who had been in Germany when there was no state of war yet between the two countries, and had talked about various ways of preventing war. But Kelly believed, and I think I'm in agreement with him here, that Goering was not making serious peace overtures. I think these were more on the lines of sounding out the English to see what they would accept and what they wouldn't. Goering was 100% in favor of Hitler's plans at the beginning of the war, and continued to be very faithful to Hitler throughout almost the entire war until the final days. And even in captivity in Nuremberg, Goering did have minor criticisms of Hitler's conduct during the war, but never criticized the German government's conduct or method of waging war or breaking of treaties. Goering was rather proud of the way they had broken treaties. And Goering, to the very end, would not break his allegiance to the Nazi government, and he tried to persuade his fellow prisoners to stand in solidarity with him in that.
What was his attitude when questioned about Hitler's idea of the superiority and, of course, as a result, the inferiority of and the mass extermination of Jewish people? How did they defend that, or did they? What was their viewpoint when Kelly interviewed them, or Goering and the others?
It's difficult to know what Goering really thought, because he was always with Kelly and with others, always in the process of manipulating and presenting a face of some kind. What he told Kelly was that Goering did not join the Nazi Party because he was a big believer in the Nazi philosophies. That instead he joined the Nazi Party early on in the early 1920s because it was a small party, a small group that was working to overthrow what many Germans considered the poisonous provisions of the Treaty of Versailles. And it was a party that Goering believed he could rise quickly to power in. He was an opportunist. He wanted to gather power and lead, and he saw the Nazi Party as a way to do this, as the means to do this. And this is what he explained to Kelly. He claimed not to be anti-Semitic, but he certainly went along, more than went along. He was a designer, an architect of the Holocaust. He never faced up to that, never admitted that in his talks with Kelly or in the trial. So, as I said, it's hard to know what Goering really thought, but he presented himself as a patriot, as somebody who wanted power, found a way, found a ladder to climb, and took his chance.
Now, part of the assessment initially for Kelly is to find out, again, he doesn't know, he has some assumptions, I guess, or preconceptions. He administers IQ tests to these 22 Nazis, starting with Goering and some of the others that you mentioned in the book. What was the results of those IQ tests?
Well, the IQ test results were quite interesting. Almost all of the 22 Nazis held for the first trial scored very high, and Goering was among the two or three highest. Goering's IQ tested at 138. The lowest, who tested at 106, was Julius Streicher, who was a newspaper publisher, published a viciously anti-Semitic newspaper called Der Stürmer, and he was probably not because of his relatively low intelligence, but for a whole host of other reasons, was not very popular among his fellow Germans, who considered him vile and crude and rude and a pornographer and all kinds of unflattering qualities that they saw in him. But the IQ tests showed that that these German leaders, both the civilian leaders and the military leaders, were by and large very intelligent men, which shows you that intelligence and high moral standing are not at all necessarily two qualities that go together.
Right. Now, as we mentioned, as you mentioned, that Kelly was a really big advocate and believer in the Rorschach testing. So what were the results with Hermann Goering? And mention a few of the other characters, too, because there's some strong characters, Rosenberg, Ribbentrop, and Hess as well. Maybe you can tell us what some of the results were, but starting with Hermann Goering.
Well, when Kelly tested Goering using the Rorschach ink blots, he found a very willing participant. Goering loved doing this kind of thing because he was bored,
sure,
and because he also took a professional interest in these kinds of assessments. He told Kelly that he wished.
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. Powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley. For the love of home.
That his German Air Force had been able to use this kind of test to assess personality. That was really unknowingly an ironic comment, because it was the Nazi government's anti-Semitic policies that led a very large number of Jewish physicians and psychiatrists to leave Germany before the war, and that's why these kinds of tests were not commonly used in the German government. But Goering loved doing this kind of thing, and he put a lot of effort into his responses. Some of his responses were quite imaginative. Kelly saw a lot of imagination and creativity in Goering's responses. Some of Goering's responses seemed to Kelly to be self-referential. So he said that he saw in one picture, one ink blot, Goering said that he saw a fat goblin, which Kelly thought could be a reference to, an unconscious reference to himself. So what Kelly found in Goering through the Rorschach was some narcissism, a very high regard for himself, some disregard for the feelings of other people, some imaginative qualities, but nothing that would, in Kelly's mind, point to a serious psychological disorder. He did see that, though, in one of the other Nazi defendants, and that was a man named Robert Ley, who was the head of a German organization called the German Labor Front, which was mass trade union of all German workers, a government-run union of workers. And Robert Ley gave...
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Very poor responses to the ink blot. He could not correct ink blots. He could not correctly recognize colors. His answers really didn't make much sense. And on the basis of Robert Ley's responses, Kelly did diagnose him with a disorder or a mental condition. He believed that Lay had damaged frontal lobes in his brain. And Kelly speculated that this may have occurred because during World War I, Lay had been a pilot, and his plane had crashed, and Lay may have suffered brain damage at that time. And Kelly had so much faith and interest in this diagnosis of frontal lobe damage that a terrible thing happened just before the trial started. Lay managed to commit suicide in his cell. And right away, Kelly wanted that man's brain so that it could be examined to see if the frontal lobe damage that he had predicted actually was there. So Kelly asked the prison pathologist to remove the brain, and then they smuggled it out of the prison, shipped it to the Surgeon General's office in Washington in a little crate that was marked spices, and at the Surgeon General's office, another pathologist did an examination and told Kelly, yes, there was evidence here of frontal lobe damage, and Kelly was jubilant that he had correctly done this diagnosis. However, a little while later, the same pathologist told him, backed off a little bit and said, well, maybe not. So some of the others in varying ways cooperated with the Rorschach test. Rudolf Hess really did not give answers at all, resisted giving answers, thinking that that would prevent Kelly from giving him a psychological assessment. It didn't have that effect, because even when a subject taking the Rorschach intentionally gives a bad answer or refuses to answer, there are still other things that the examiner can look at in order to come to some findings. And some of the others who took part, Alfred Rosenberg, who kind of had an odd role in the Nazi government. He was sort of the party philosopher among the Nazis, and he did serve as minister of the Eastern Occupied Territories also during a very bloody period of the war. And Rosenberg was extremely unimaginative in his Rorschach responses. But again, there was nothing that pointed to some kind of psychiatric disorder.
Right. Now, Kelly and Gehring, again, have this relationship that you say, this not maybe an admiration, because Kelly does not seem to be, he just seems to be unbiased, basically. I don't see him, you know, being so charmed by Gehring, but what was it that Gehring wanted to do with this Nuremberg trial and that Kelly was aware of in terms of what he had to say, and if he was going to use this trial as some form of, not bully pulpit, but, you know, a stage for himself to be able to express some of the things that he wanted to say. Tell us about that, those conversations that they had between them.
Well, Gehring was in an interesting position as the trial neared and occurred, because he was the biggest Nazi left standing. Hitler had committed suicide. Several of the other Nazi leaders had committed suicide or disappeared. So that left Gehring, and he believed that he had, you know, that this trial was an opportunity for him to build upon his legacy. If the others were going to depart without getting a word in because of their deaths and suicides, well, then Gehring was going to get his word in. And he told the other defendants, when they finally had a chance to confer during the trial, that if they stood together and did not waver in their support of each other and of the Nazi policies, that they would be remembered in Germany and throughout Europe. They would be memorialized and thought upon, remembered well. So this is one thing that Gehring was trying to do. It was very self-serving. and really pointed to Goering's narcissism, because he was mostly concerned with his own image, and he knew that most of his fellow defendants would be sentenced to death, and so he thought this was their chance to get their word out. And in the early months of the trial, he did a very good job of making his case and overcoming the attacks of the Allied prosecutors, but that fell apart by the middle of the trial, and he wasn't able to hang on to that advantage. And so losing that advantage, there was still one way that Goering could control things, and that was in the way that his life would end. As it turned out, Goering and many of the others were sentenced to death by hanging. Goering believed that a hanging execution was a very ignominious way to go out. He equated execution by hanging with the fate of common criminals. Of course, the tribunal had judged him to be a criminal, one of the worst kinds, but Goering saw himself more as a national leader and felt that there were more dignified ways to go, and he took advantage of that. The night before he and the others were supposed to be hanged, he swallowed a cyanide capsule, one that he had had in among his possessions the entire time since his capture, and it appears that an American guard helped him get access to one or two of those capsules that were in his luggage, and he used it and took his own life that way, went out on his own terms. And it's interesting the way that Kelly responded to this suicide. By this time, Kelly was no longer in Nuremberg and was in San Francisco. He heard about Kelly's suicide. Goering's suicide. He did not expect Goering to take his own life, but he was in admiration of it, and he thought that Goering had succeeded in going out his way, in defying the American authorities, and he believed that Goering may have succeeded in establishing a legacy for himself. Fortunately, as it turned out, that wasn't the case. But Kelly saw Goering's suicide as an example of a kind of suicide in which someone takes control, manages their own fate, and makes almost a theatrical statement of the death, something that will remain in people's memories and influence them long after the person is gone.
What did Kelly conclude in terms of his disregard for almost anyone around him? You said he was a loyal, I guess he saw himself as a soldier and he was loyal to his country, but Kelly found that he really didn't give a damn about almost anyone. But what did he make of his affection and obvious pain from the treatment of his family? Again, we didn't touch on that he was involved with some art theft, and so that didn't help his wife and his child's treatment. But tell us a little bit about what he made of that sort of dichotomy.
Well, it really perplexed Kelly. Goering's affection for his family was genuine. And when Goering did not hear for a long time from his wife and his daughter, it very much depressed him. And then on the other hand, when Goering did hear through letters that Kelly carried, did hear from his family, he was elated. So it was very perplexing to Kelly, and part of what he could not figure out about the Nazis in general, that these guys who were in many cases good family men could be so evil, if that's the right word to be used, in their official activities and the way they ran the war. So Kelly was was perplexed. One interesting thing that came out of Goering's concern for his family was that there was a time when Goering approached Kelly, and Goering was worried that he would not survive his captivity, that his wife might not. So if they both did not, what would happen to their daughter, Etta, who was just a young girl? And Goering asked Kelly if he would, that is, Kelly would adopt young Etta, if it came to that, and raise her in the United States, which is shocking, unfathomable, yeah, almost, that Goering would make a request like this. I was not able to find out exactly how Kelly responded to that, except that he brought the news of it back to his wife when he returned to the States. But it shows, you know, the level of concern that Goering had for his family.
There was a part in your book, too, where Kelly is offered a ring from Goering, but instead something else happens. So tell us about that exchange. That's very telling, I believe.
Right. When Goering was arrested, he had all kinds of valuables in his possession. Jewelry, gemstones, gold cigarette cases, watches, also a large amount of cash, German cash. And all of these were documented in some inventories that I found at the National Archives. And Goering was not able to keep these items in his cell with him, but they were stored with the rest, with his excess clothing and other belongings. And he was able at times to get guards to bring some of these items to him. So during one conversation that Kelly and Goering were having in Goering's cell, I guess at a time when Goering was feeling especially warm or convivial towards Kelly, he offered to give Kelly this gigantic emerald that he had that was surely very, very valuable. And Kelly had to refuse. He did refuse. And Goering was a little bit put out by that, but instead had another idea that he could give Kelly something that he wouldn't have to refuse, and that was an autographed photographic portrait of Goering in his, you know, all his glory. So Kelly did accept that, and that was among the items that I found in the boxes when I examined Dr. Kelly's papers.
That's amazing. Now, getting back to Kelly's work, he has an idea for writing a book, and he stays, like you said, for, is it 6 months or so?
About 5 months.
In examining these, or was it a little bit longer than that?
The amount of time that Kelly spent with the Nazis, is that what you're asking?
Yeah.
Yeah, that was about 5 months.
Okay. Now, his plans for a book, there's another interesting character that happens to come to Nuremberg, and his name is Gilbert.
Right.
Maybe Gilbert, but Gilbert. And he's a psychologist. So tell us briefly about that relationship and why Gilbert was sent to the prison, and did they collaborate at all, Kelly and Gilbert?
Dr. Gilbert, who was a Ph.D. psychologist, arrived at the prison after Kelly had already been there for 2 or 3 months. And Dr. Gilbert's official role was to be a translator for Kelly. Gilbert was fluent in German. He was American-born, but his parents were both from Germany, so he was fluent in German. But as a psychologist, he had some of the same interests as Kelly and saw this this time that he was spending with the Nazis also as a great opportunity for study. But Gilbert was different from Kelly in several ways. his fluency in German was one thing that separated him from Kelly, who was not fluent in German and needed the services of a translator for talking with some of the prisoners. But Dr. Gilbert was also Jewish, and that set him apart from Kelly, who was not Jewish, in how the prisoners regarded and approached him. Many of the prisoners professed not to care, that they said it didn't influence them that Dr. Gilbert was Jewish, but some of the most anti-Semitic of the prisoners, especially Stryker and Rosenberg.
For those who embrace the impossible, the Defender 110 is up for the adventure. This iconic vehicle has been redefined with a modern design that lets you go further and do more. The exterior is reimagined with compelling proportions and precise detailing, complemented by an interior built with integrity. The Defender capability is legendary. Whether you're facing off-road challenges or harsh weather conditions, its durability has been tested to the extreme. Powerful innovations like the intuitive driver display and award-winning infotainment system keep you connected. Innovative camera technologies deliver unobstructed views and effortless maneuvering. And robust cargo capacity means more room for your gear. Ready for a wide range of adventures, the Defender family features the two-door Defender 90, the Defender 110, and the Defender 130, which seats up to 8. To drive the Defender is to explore with greater confidence. Push what's possible with a vehicle made to go further. The Defender 110. Learn more at LandRoverUSA.com/Defender.
Hey parents, Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list, teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.
Whether you're a morning person or a bedtime procrastinator, everyone deserves a mattress that works for their style. And you'll find the best mattress for you at Ashley. The new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley brings you one-of-a-kind body-conforming technology, making every sleep tailored to be your best. The collection also features cool-to-the-touch covers and motion absorption to help minimize sleep disruptions from partners, pets, or kids. Shop the all-new Tempur-Adapt collection at Ashley in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.
Did have problems with Gilbert, and also Goering did not get along with him for personality reasons. They just did not click. But because of their similar interests, Gilbert and Kelly decided at one point that they would collaborate in their study of the Nazis and produce a book together when all this was over. That was their plan. But as time went on, Kelly and Gilbert, it became apparent that they didn't work very well together. They didn't like each other all that much. And so Kelly, when he left Nuremberg in January 1946, by that time it's clear that he had given up on the idea of collaborating with Gilbert, although he may not have told Gilbert this, and he went home with a lot of the papers that they had jointly worked on and a lot of the tests that they had jointly administered. And Gilbert was understandably very angry about this. He thought Kelly had broken their agreement. But Kelly went home and decided to do a book on his own, which was the book 22 Cells in Nuremberg. When Gilbert stayed for the remainder of the trial and then went home, and he then went to work on his own book, which was called Nuremberg Diary. Both of these you can still find from used booksellers, and Nuremberg Diary may still be in print. But they came to somewhat different conclusions about the Nazis. Kelly believed, as we've discussed, that the testing and interviewing showed that the Nazis were not mentally disordered. Gilbert believed that some of them were mentally disordered, so he had a different interpretation of the test results. But it's funny that their two books came out within months, weeks of each other. And Gilbert's is the one that is more read today, I think because it gives the message that these Nazi criminals were exceptional in some way. Gilbert would never have called them monsters. Maybe he would have, but Kelly would not have. He would have said that they were people a lot like people all over the world, including in the United States or in anywhere in North America, who will take advantage of situations and step on the backs of others if given the chance. So that's pretty much what the relationship was between Gilbert and Kelly. It was not good.
Now, you say they both came out around the same time. That really pretty well angered Kelly, didn't it, that that would happen? But also, what was the response to, you say that you've already said that the Nuremberg Diary was the more well-read book, but what was the professional response to the work that Kelly had done, and what was the public response to what Kelly had done, and how did Kelly react to those reactions?
Well, I'll start with the public response. There was a great deal of public interest, and when Kelly returned to the United States, he did a lot of lecturing all over the country, talking about the personalities of the men he had met at Nuremberg, and giving character sketches and telling anecdotes, but also delivering with his talks a warning, which was that since he believed these men were not psychiatrically exceptional, that there was the potential for such men to arise anytime, any place. And in fact, Kelly saw such men arising at the time, and this is the late 1940s, in the U.S. South. The Southern segregationist politicians believed in racial differences and manipulated their constituents based on their perception of racial differences. Kelly believed that the Southern politicians were quite cynically using the ignorance and misperceptions of the Southern citizens to acquire power. And he spoke out a lot against them. What the public took away from Kelly's work. Other psychiatrists, the response was different. There was a lot of controversy about these Rorschach tests of the Nazis. And in fact, those tests are probably the most studied Rorschachs in all of history. Over the decades, many groups of psychiatrists have examined them and have fallen into two camps regarding them. One is a camp that agrees with Kelly and has not found anything or much unusual or exceptional in them. And then there was the camp that would agree with Gilbert that there are worse signs of psychiatric disorder that you can see in these Rorschachs. So, And that dispute has gone on for a long time and has continued until quite recently. There was a book published 10 or 15 years ago in which a team again looked at these Rorschachs and brought in some new thinking, some new ways of assessing them and examining them, and pretty much came down on Kelly's side, that there wasn't a lot unusual to be found in them.
What did Kelly categorize? He compared businessmen, didn't he? Did he said that the same type of mentality he could see in aggressive businessmen with a focused goal, like setting up a new government?
Kelly did see the Nazi government as a kind of corporate hierarchy. He compared the Nazi leaders to a corporate board, with Hitler as the CEO, and then the other leaders as controllers of their own areas, not communicating very well to one another, and presiding over what I think today would be called silos within the company. And so that was one way in which Hitler looked at the Nazis, but also he found that the traits that were apparent in the Rorschachs, some of the narcissism and the single-mindedness that he saw in the assessments, you know, these are not necessarily bad traits, and they're quite common. And Kelly thought that they were especially common among two groups of people in America, and those were politicians and also people involved in business. And he thought that someone could use these, someone with this sort of personality could be very successful in business and certainly do no harm to anybody, but that under the right circumstances, the right environment, perhaps some of these people might lust for more power and commit horrible, heinous crimes.
Now, when Kelly gets back to America, what's interesting in the book, I find it fascinating how vivid you paint this picture of Kelly coming back home. He has his own little den. He has this beautiful home. Very much like his father, he's influenced about collecting artifacts and exhibiting them in the home. Tell us a little bit more about the home and then his family life, and what was this brilliant mind, Kelly, what was he really like as a family man, a husband and a father?
Eventually, the Kelly family settled in Berkeley, California, where Kelly had gotten a quite prestigious position as a professor, not of psychiatry, but of criminology. And they settled into a house in an area called Kensington, which is a bedroom community of Berkeley, quite affluent and beautiful. And Kelly did have an office within his home, which overlooked the bay, he had a beautiful, fantastic view of the bay, including a view of Alcatraz Island. And by this time, the Kellys, he and Dookie, had three children, two boys and a girl. And Doug, the person who I had eventually tracked down, was the oldest of the three. And Kelly was a difficult father to have. He was a perfectionist, he was a workaholic, he was an alcoholic, and he had a violent temper. And he drove himself very, very hard. And I believe that this happened because of the way he was raised, but also because of the things he had seen in Nuremberg, his failure to come up with a psychiatric reason for the Nazis' behavior, his change of professional focus to criminology, and in the frightful similarities that I believe he found between himself and Goering. So he just worked himself terribly hard. The children and Doug described this to me in interviews, many interviews I had with him. The children knew that their father loved them, but he was a rough father, and they never knew what kind of mood he would be in, whether he would be soused from beer drinking or not. And there was a time when Doug contemplated killing his father with an axe. And all of this came to a climax, this bad family situation. And there had been a time earlier when, during an argument with his wife, and Kelly often fought with his wife, he had fired a gun at her into the floor. And the bullet hole was still there in the floor of their home under a carpet. So it all came to a climax on New Year's Day in 1958. And I'm not giving a spoiler here in talking about this because it's described in the opening pages of the book. When Kelly and his wife did have a terrible argument during a family gathering, when the children were there and when Kelly's father was there, And Kelly stormed out of the kitchen where they had been arguing. He went upstairs into his office, stayed up there a while, and Kelly had all kinds of things up in that office of his. He had skulls and medical equipment and laboratory equipment and dangerous chemicals. And he came down with something in his palm of his hand and screamed out to his family, I can't take this anymore, it's too much. And he popped this chemical that he had in his hand into his mouth. And it turned out to be cyanide, the same poison that Goering had used to take his life. And it was not long, less than a minute, and Kelly was dead. And I was able to paint a detailed picture of that scene because Doug witnessed it. He was 10 years old at the time, has a very clear memory of it, and it was a horrible thing to hear from him and a very difficult thing to write, too. But that's how Dr. Kelly's life ended.
Yeah, it's an incredible story of a man really searching for answers, and I mean, this man was at the forefront of psychiatry, and he was highly regarded, and he really did look at this opportunity, took this opportunity very, very seriously, and again, it seemed like in your book, not so much of a conclusion, but my own conclusion, I think, that he was just haunted by those demons of the questions he couldn't answer, and again, in his lectures, it almost was a cautionary tale that they weren't, like Gilbert had described, these aberrations, these monsters, but that was the scary thing. So I don't know if that's the conclusion you came to as well, that this man was just haunted by his inadequacies in coming up with answers for, again, the biggest question of his life.
Yes, well, I agree with that. And another thing that contributed to it all was that Kelly, by the end, was turning on himself. He was more than frustrated. He was angry at himself and believed that he was in an unfriendly world. Tragically, his wife had urged him over the years to seek psychiatric help, and he had refused because he thought it would destroy his image, for he was still known as a great psychiatrist and as an important criminologist, and for someone like that to pursue psychiatric help, he thought would just destroy his image, and it probably would have destroyed his self-image, unfortunately.
Was part of this incredible frustration that you write in the book that 22 Cells, he bought the rights for the book, I think, for a measly sum anyway, even though it was, we're talking many years ago. But, and as we know from publishing, there must be some reason why you're able to buy the rights. So the book wasn't as successful as he had hoped for at all, was it?
No, it wasn't. It did not sell many copies. And it's hard to know the exact reason for that. I speculate that the reason was that it gave a message that that the public didn't want to hear, which was that the Nazis were not monsters. The book did help. Did help him get speaking engagements, and he loved public speaking and did a lot of that. But it certainly didn't bring him the kind of money that he hoped. And it was out of print in just a few years. It did briefly go back in print for a few years after his death, but is out of print and has remained out of print for a long time.
Incredible. Yes, well, it's an amazing story, Jack. And what do you get from, at the end of all of this, what do you come away from, especially learning, and what was the most profound thing that you got from writing this and doing this entire project?
Well, strangely, working on this book made me think a lot about my own profession. journalism and biography, because what I do in my writing is sometimes similar to what Dr. Kelly did in his interactions with the Nazis. I interview people. I try and draw conclusions about their motivations and the reasons for their behavior. And in Dr. Kelly's case, he was going face to face with some pretty fearsome characters, people who had done some terrible, terrible things, and he ended up not being able to explain that. So it made me reflect a little bit upon my work when I'm writing about people who are difficult to explain and who have done some terrible things. What kind of jeopardy am I putting myself in, and by extension, to other journalists and biographers as well? It's just a sobering thing to think about the effect that it has on us when we write about troubled people who have done criminal things. It is something that I maybe people who more often write true crime books have to grapple with. But this was my opportunity this is my time to grapple with it. And it's given me a lot of food for thought.
Yes, I think your book is not typical of true crime books, but I think you're bang on in your assessment, in that I think the authors must suffer at some point in the why, and there are, at the end of a book project, there's probably more questions than definitive answers.
It's a good thing, I think, that there are a lot of questions at the end. That's the purpose of literature, I think, to make us think and to formulate questions. Yes, sometimes answers too, but sometimes the questions are more important than the answers.
Yes, absolutely. Well, I want to thank you, Jack, for coming on and talking about this incredible book, The Nazi and the Psychiatrist, Hermann Göring, Dr. Douglas M. Kelly, and A Fatal Meeting of Minds at the End of World War II. A fascinating book. I want to thank you very much. How can people contact you? Do you do the Facebook thing? And is there any way, if anybody's interested, or, again, any contact information you might be able to provide for those interested?
The best way for readers to reach me is through my website, and that the URL for that website is lhai.com, and that's el-hai.com. And if someone wants to write to me, there's a place on the website they can write to me, and place they can find out more about this book and some of the other books that I've written too. That's the best way. You can follow me on Twitter as well. My Twitter handle is jack_elhai. I'm not much of a Facebook person, so the website is the best way.
Absolutely. Well, I want to thank you once again, Jack, for this engaging interview, and thank you very much. And hope to talk to you again real soon. Thank you.
Thank you for the great discussion, Dan. I appreciate it.
Well, have a great night. Good night.
Good night.
Hey, parents. Greenlight is here to take one big thing off your to-do list: teaching your kids about money. With a Greenlight debit card and money app of their own, kids and teens learn to earn, save, and invest. You can send money instantly, set flexible controls, and get real-time notifications of your kids' money activity. Set up chores and put allowance on autopilot to reward them for their hard work. Then learn about the world of money together. Get 1 month free when you sign up at greenlight.com/podcast.